Okay, so we are recording now.
Brilliant. Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Right Dishonourable podcast. My name is Jazza, and I am joined, as ever, with my co-host, Jimmy Nichols.
Hello.
Hello. Sorry, I'll try and make my introductions less butlins for you. Basically, we talk about politics, social issues, and current events every week. We're on our 51st episode.
I'm impressed you remembered. I had to look up before the show started.
Well, it's because last week was like the 50-episode milestone. I feel like we should have had a cake or something.
We should have done that. I thought you were so distraught over what happened the week before that it probably wouldn't have been appropriate.
You're not allowed to make light of this yet, Jimmy. I'm still very angry at you.
I was making light of it in the previous episode, so...
I was clearly ecstatic about the whole thing. If you want to go back and listen to episode 50, dear listener, then you can hear me just basically be furious and seething at Jimmy for about an hour. It was great fun.
You're always pretty moody, to be honest. I didn't notice a significant difference.
I had no idea you had such a low opinion of me, Jimmy.
Sorry.
What a dick! It all comes out now, blimey!
Yeah, as soon as you press record. So, aside from our interpersonal relationship issues, what are we talking about this podcast?
We're going to do a leadership special, I suppose, because all of the people who had anything to do with Brexit seem to have been gone, we voted for it now, we're going to bugger off, see ya, have fun cleaning up, guys, have a good time. Today we had Nigel Farage resign... again, as the leader of the UK Independence Party.
You shouldn't really be able to say that about anyone in any kind of occupation. Resigning is supposed to be a one-time thing, really.
I believe it was BuzzFeed who worded it as Nigel Farage does his annual resignation. Because it was pretty much exactly a year ago that he first resigned from UKIP and then was like, oh no, it was just kind of like a prolonged holiday, really.
Yeah, what even was that all about? Is he going to come back after the summer? Is that what this is all about? He just wants a bit of a break?
Well, the big thing about Nigel Farage leaving is that it's going to have, I think, huge implications for Labour. While they are currently in disarray and still not technically having a leadership race, but are trying the parliamentary party, the PLP, all of the MPs of Labour are currently trying to get Jeremy Corbyn, their dear benevolent leader, to quit. Not very successfully.
I think you put it quite well in your the video you uploaded to Facebook and I assume your YouTube channel. It's the worst coup of all time, like the least impressive coup.
Yeah, it's like they're trying to be desperately polite about it. They don't do resignations or coups in the same way that the Tories do, really, do they?
They need to get Michael Gove on board, because the way he fucked Boris over, frankly, a masterclass.
A masterclass is a way of putting it.
A masterclass in country, I suppose, is one way you could put it. I mean, it was...
Speaking of country, we'll also be talking about the Conservative leadership contest, of which there are five individuals running to be not just the leader of the Conservative Party, but our next bloody Prime Minister. And I ranted about this in the video that I put up today as well, the fact that 0.2% of the population are now going to be deciding who's going to run the country. So that's you voted for democracy, didn't you, Jimmy?
So you're referring to the 150,000 Tory members who ultimately get to vote after the MPs have whittled it down to two candidates on the Tory leader. Just to explain to listeners what's going on there. Mm-hmm. I suppose we will just in the background talk about the vague prospect of there being a general election at some point, which is the official reason why Labour have decided to rebel, although most of the Tories have at this point said there won't be a general election. So... who knows exactly what's going on there? And also the invocation of...
I think that would be ridiculous, though. But we'll talk about that later.
We will talk about that. And also how that relates to the invocation of Article 50, which is the official legal mechanism by which we should be leaving the EU now we voted on it, although it's looking a bit sketchy as to
whether... Can you briefly explain what Article 50 is and how it works?
So it's in one of the European treaties.
I believe it's Lisbon.
And it's the mechanism by which any member state of the EU leaves the EU. So they have to tell the European Council which is the collection of all the various like presidents and prime ministers from across the EU in an official formal declaration that they intend to leave the EU, and that starts a two-year negotiation process, after which, if even if nothing's been agreed in that negotiation process, you're out, you're no longer part of the EU.
Yeah, it's going to be loads of fun, because having a tight deadline of 2 years of negotiations isn't going to benefit the guys who have all the cards, in this case, the EU at all, is it?
On that note, shall we turn to Nigel Farage, your best bud?
I'm not bitter. I'm not bitter at all. Just play some music.
So, Jazza, were you surprised when Nigel Farage announced he was resigning as leader of UKIP today?
I've ceased to be surprised by anything, to be completely honest, Jimmy.
I mean, would you be surprised if Boris Johnson ran for leader of the Labourship?
Labourship?
Labourship, leader of the Labour Party, I should say, at this point. Would that surprise you?
No, to be honest. Although, yes, that would be absolutely ridiculous. I was genuinely shocked when Boris dropped out. But we're talking about Nigel at the minute.
We should focus on Nigel, yeah.
I am surprised, jokes aside, because he has persistently put his own personal ego and interests before his party. It's worth noting that Nigel Farage is not the leader of is not the founder of UKIP. It was actually founded by a relatively modest academic in the London School of Economics, who has since completely chastised the UK Independence Party. Way back when UKIP were first founded, they didn't used to take their seats in the European Parliament because of, you know, principle. And that very rapidly descended into MEPs being able, taking as much money as they could from the Euro machine so that the UK could campaign to leave. It's been quite a ridiculous shit show under Nigel Farage. And also, I've been surprised that he's been here this long as the leader, because he's such a divisive figure.
It should be said, the original UKIP party was far more to do with like constitutional arrangements, and it was far more academic and considered than the I don't know what is a vaguely polite way of putting this, the more earthy kind of approach that
they're not a candle set, Jimmy. Bloody
hell. You know, more like crude, I suppose, the cruder approach that we've seen under Nigel Farage. I mean, I'm not sure that I think he's been a good leader for UKIP, in as much as he's raised their profile, and ultimately he's achieved his political aims. I mean, somebody made the point that there's this famous phrase that the Conservative politician Enoch Powell once said. Enoch Powell is somebody who Nigel Farage has said that he really admires, but is infamous for giving this
The Rivers of Blood speech,
which is, you know, generally seen as having shut down the immigration debate because it used this racist, inflammatory rhetoric. Some people have argued that he wasn't actually advocating those views, but for, you know, whatever the truth or untruth of that is, it has been seen as a landmark speech. But Enoch Powell said all political careers end in failure, and seemingly Nigel Farage's political career, if this is indeed the last thing that he does in politics, has ended in success.
Brilliant. Good for him. So he has definitely raised the profile of UKIP, but also, I think, especially in general elections, has been a very strong kind of, created a very strong ceiling for people who pride themselves on their decency. Something I'm not entirely sure
what you mean by that.
I'm not even being funny. So my boyfriend watched the video of him basically being a really sore winner in the
a smug winner, we should say.
A really smug winner in the European Parliament. And he said something along the lines of, I used to think that Nigel Farage maybe had some good like policy points, but he just really is a foul human being. And he isn't a very nice human being. I've been, this is politics, we shouldn't talk about personalities too much, but I've been lucky enough to meet quite a few of the party leaders in my time, And I've met Nigel Farage a couple of times, and he isn't a nice person.
Is it that he gives off a slightly oily, unpleasant vibe in person?
He's just rude and foul to people.
Yeah.
If you're not part of his crew, then you're not worth listening to, and you're treated like you're scum of the earth, to be completely honest. And that's my personal experience with him in a vaguely professional capacity. But the thing is, this is probably the best thing that he could have possibly done for UKIP. He's managed to raise the profile of UK leaving the EU, and now they get to pivot to be a party that's actually that loses a lot of that indecency that has been marred by Nigel Farage's leadership. And I'm very worried that if we do have a snap election quite soon, or even in 2020, if UKIP manage to rebrand themselves as the people who talk for the working class and people who talk for all of the Brexiters, and you know exactly what you get on the tin, but still manage to get rid of all of quite a lot of the xenophobic and racist rhetoric that has happened under Nigel Farage, then they could sweep the North. Easily.
So your view is that with Nigel Farage leaving, that drains some of the poison out of UKIP?
Yeah, completely. I mean, I think that beside Nigel Farage, outside of Nigel Farage, yes, there is the odd councillor that has to get sacked because they call people of colour gollywogs, or they say that gay people should be hung, drawn and quartered, or one of the many things that some UKIP officials have said in the past, but I think that is overwhelmingly overshadowed by Nigel Farage as a person, the fact that he is able to tolerate it. And if you have someone like Suzanne Evans to kind of take over the helm, then that detoxifies that particularly nasty part of the party, and it makes them more electable.
See, I thought some of the appeal of Nigel Farage was that there's obviously like this thin undercurrent, is maybe putting it a bit mildly, but an undercurrent of, you said he's...
It's not an undercurrent, it's a fucking tsunami.
Well, I think we're somewhat mixing metaphors here, but you know what I mean, there's this kind of surface level of bigotry, basically, that he to some degree legitimizes, and I think that people are, it's that whole thing of people saying, well, Nigel Farage, he tells it like it is, where basically what they mean by that is he says unpleasant things that I'm already thinking, and therefore that's to me, that's part of what UKIP's appeal is about. I'm not saying all kippers are
racist, but
I think that's part of it.
Those people were always going to be voting UKIP, yeah. If they are going to become a proper electoral force, then they are going to need to be able to appeal to a lot of the working class people, and the majority of them are working class people who voted for us to leave the European Union. And them being able to detoxify that and make themselves more palatable to people who were perhaps quite standoffish about voting for that kind of party in the past, that's only going to be good for them, to be completely honest.
So
because of our voting system...
There's a point that I want to bring up just in relation to what you just said. There's an academic called Matthew Goodwin who's written two books on UKIP, actually. He's sort of the Britain's resident UKIP expert, and he made the point
that's a depressing job.
In some ways, but you know, he's made a career out of it, I suppose. But he made the point that one of the things that always held back groups like the National Front and the British National Party, and I suppose holds back organisations like the English Defence League as well, is that British nationalism was always very intertwined with being anti-fascist because of Britain's historic role beating the Nazis. And that always put a certain ceiling on the success of groups like the National Front, because... Even if you're a British nationalist, you're not going to want to associate with an openly fascist organisation because, it, you know, just there's an intellectual cut or an identity incoherence there, which I guess matches up with your point that UKIP, to some degree, created kind of an acceptable party or an acceptable vehicle for those kind of views, not racist views, but like views that are against immigration and that sort of thing.
So I've been bashing UKIP quite a lot, and I should probably say that I know a few people who are UKIP members and supporters, and there are grievances about being part of the European Union. And to be honest, they've seen him... These are like intellectual people who see Nigel Farage as a barrier to them being a party that's taken seriously. What I think is probably going to happen with Labour in such disarray and particularly weak... like across the country, not least in Scotland, but also across the north of England, where UKIP comes second place to them in many elections. I worry now that with Labour, with weak leadership, and with basically being unelectable, I think that we're going to see a significant rise in the number of UKIP MEPs when we next have a general election, if they are able to elect somebody who is able to detoxify their brand.
See, the thing is, if you look at a lot of like UKIP officials, whether they be councillors or MPs or whatever, so there was someone standing in my constituency, like at the last general election, who just didn't really seem that he didn't exude an overwhelming impression of competence. And bearing in mind this guy is actually a doctor, you'd kind of think that he had better chance than most of doing so. So I'm a little bit sceptical that they will find candidates who appear to be sort of even semi-professional politicians. I think that's one thing that has always held UKIP back, is that a lot of their, to be honest, a lot of their officials are just nutters and what was Cameron's phrase? Like fruitcakes and lunatics. Or
Yeah, civilized loonies.
Yeah, I think there's a certain amount of truth to that. But obviously, UKIP did make a lot of ground at the general election, and actually, did they make a lot of ground at the local elections as well? They got a lot of, they got council seats, and they got a lot of second places in, in particularly as you say, in the north. So I do kind of find that plausible. How many seats do you reckon they'll get then? Just to give a ballpark figure.
I don't know, but I reckon they might be able to probably not challenge the SNP to be the third party, but they'd certainly kick the Lib Dems' asses, which isn't hard, to be honest. What I think is going to be hugely interesting, though, is to see what kind of policies a UKIP actually does now, actually puts forward now, because frankly, their last manifesto was an absolute shit show. They can't quite decide whether they are libertarian or super socialist, and the only thing that really united all of these people in the UK Independence Party was the desire to leave the EU. And so seeing where they end up fitting along the political spectrum now is going to be quite interesting.
I'd have thought their best chance was to actually go down the more kind of protectionist, almost, I'm not saying this to malign them, but almost the Donald Trump type route of like, globalization's bad, it's killing off local industry, Mexicans are taking our jobs sort of thing. From an intellectual point of view, that makes far more sense for their general platform and their general ethos than the kind of hardline libertarianism that even someone like Nigel Farage is kind of loosely in favour in.
But then hardline libertarianism is not what's going to win them votes. And Nigel Farage, even in his speech where he resigned, said that it was the working classes and the abandoned working classes in the north specifically that they needed to fight for. You're not going to be able to win over those votes with a libertarian platform.
I agree,
The north is still very socialist. They believe in Jeremy Corbyn's Britain a lot more than they do in a libertarian Britain without an NHS, with a privatised healthcare system, with like privatised schools, and all of those kinds of things. So it is going to be interesting whether they're going to keep the libertarian kind of like colours in their flag, or whether they're going to just go for those left-wing votes that has been frankly ignored and taken for granted by Labour all of these years.
Well, there are still significant elements within UKIP that are of a libertarian mindset, and unless they're willing just to leave...
Douglas Carswell, their sole MP, being the exemplar case of that, right?
I mean, they're an old, like... it's almost like a split in a very extreme version of the traditional split in the Tory party between free market people and more socially conservative people. There was this old kind of vein in conservative thought decades ago, which was far more protectionist and was far more hesitant about the merits of globalization and free trade. And honestly, Thatcher just blew that out of the water. But it is going to be interesting. I think it's potentially true that we could see a serious breakdown in UKIP now that Farage has left, because he has been such a dominant figure, and there's no obvious candidate to replace him. I know you mentioned Suzanne Evans, but she actually Douglas Carswell said he's not going to run. Suzanne Evans can't run at the moment because she's still suspended from the party officially. And there's also people like Paul Nuttall, who I think is the deputy leader.
Nuttall would probably continue the same kind of brand that Nigel Farage has been putting forward all of these years. I think if they want to have to be able to pose a real electoral threat in the areas that Nigel Farage mentioned in his resignation speech, they need to have somebody who is more palatable to the wider public. And somebody like Suzanne Evans would be ideal for that. I would be surprised if they blocked her from running for the leadership.
I wouldn't be surprised if they did block her, because, I mean, my most recent understanding is it's the Farageists, who don't like Suzanne Evans, who actually have control of the party machinery, which, I mean, there's obvious parallels with, like, the Corbynite case here. And one of the thing you mentioned earlier, like, Jeremy Corbyn's general platform around investment in public services and a more socialist kind of view, you said that would do better in the North. So is there an argument that Jeremy Corbyn should remain in power, because in control of the Labour Party, because he can deliver that sort of platform then?
I think that there is a vague argument for that, but I still believe that he's not the best person to put forward that argument. There are positives to having somebody on the left in charge of Labour, but the problem is that Jeremy Corbyn is such a terrible leader who is not able to rally support from his own MPs. I don't think it's necessarily the fact that he's a radical left-wing person. I think it's the fact that he's a blast from the past of the 70s and the 80s who is unable to actually lead. And I think that's the biggest grievance. I don't think it's necessarily his policies.
I think it's partly his policies. I mean, the stuff you said about his leadership is all true, but the reason that people thought he'd be a disaster before he was elected is to do with the policies, basically. And the reason that the Blairites are trying to unseat him is partly a competence thing, but it's partly that they're not happy with the ideological direction that the party's taken in the since Corbyn was elected, basically.
But the problem is that when you have somebody who is so far left as Corbyn is, that is going to appeal to a certain part of the electorate. And I think that it is places like ex-coal mining towns, places that have lost a lot of their industry, places that were decimated under Thatcher and never really picked up again and have only voted against Tories in their whole in their political existence. It didn't really matter who Labour put forward. They could have put a rosette on a donkey, as somebody in Question Time last week said, and somebody would vote for it, because it wasn't the Tories, and it was how you kept the Tories out. As soon as you have somebody like Jeremy Corbyn, that's going to make them want to vote Labour. I think that UKIP become a problem for Labour, especially in these kinds of communities, if they have a leadership coup that is apparently going to be happening with Angela Eagle trying to apparently seeking to run against him if he doesn't step down. I think that those areas become ripe for the picking for UKIP if they end up having a more Blairite candidate.
Isn't Labour's problem, though, more on the kind of social axis of things, like Labour's just complete unwillingness to really give very much ground on immigration? Whenever they're challenged on immigration by their supporters, they struggle to give a convincing response, because a lot of the people who are in charge of Labour are cosmopolitan types who approve of immigration and approve of diversity, and a lot of the people they're trying to appeal to are the opposite of that. So it's not merely the economic argument. There's also a a cultural argument and a level of cultural insecurity there that it's difficult for Labour to look
but that's
to
again,
answer to.
But that's again part of the problem in that Labour does not represent the people that it's meant to that it is meant to represent anymore. It hasn't for decades, and they've just managed to get into power by not being the Conservative Party, as I said. I said this in I keep on referencing my video because it's brilliant, but Ed Miliband is a representative for Doncaster. Ed Miliband is not from Doncaster. He's got a he had a very privileged upbringing, spent some time in public schools, had a father who was a socialist academic at the London School of Economics, lived in America, and then somebody decided, oh, Ed, you can have a nice safe seat in Doncaster. They'll never vote for anything other than Labour. And that has meant that, and the same goes for somebody like Jeremy Corbyn. Realistically, Jeremy Corbyn has never had to fight for his seat, and so it doesn't really matter. Even though he's seen as being a very good constituency MP, it doesn't really matter what his constituents think, as long as they keep on voting them in. And they vote him in at like 60% every single time that we have a general election. And so he's never really had to worry about the concerns of his constituents. And I think that that's true for a large number of Labour MPs, which is why, and I know that I rabbit on about this a huge amount, which is why we need a more representative voting system in this country.
But even if you got a Labour MP from Doncaster who was demographically far more similar, far more in tune with the local populace, unless they're willing to advocate a policy of reduced migration, not necessarily no migration, but unless they're willing to do that, I don't really see them winning over people who are inclined to vote for UKIP. I think that's a fundamental problem in Labour's platform at the moment, and it's an ideological problem. It's not merely a demographic problem. So
I think one of the reasons that immigration specifically as an issue has come to an head so much is because it was repressed for so long. It's because people talked about it as xenophobia and racism without ever thinking that they had to engage with it, because they knew that people would vote for them anyway. And I think there is a certain amount of truth to that. I think that you can win those people over, though, because immigration can be good for these communities. Immigration is good for the country as a whole. And what you do is you engage with those arguments, but not by beating them down before they've even had a chance to voice their proper opinions. When I watched, there was a documentary I watched the other week that actually showed a series of interviews with people from Doncaster, and immigration comes up as like the first thing, the reason that people chose to vote Leave in the EU referendum. But then when you dig deeper, immigration actually isn't the issue. The issue is that their livelihoods have been decimated, that their communities are being destroyed. That's what the issue is. And because there is a huge amount of media attention on immigration as an issue, and because they see it as a battle because nobody wants to engage with them on that topic, because of that perfect storm, it seems that there is a huge amount of xenophobia and fear of immigration in this country. I don't think that if you are able to engage with those people and you're able to provide an environment where they where communities that are multicultural are allowed to exist, I don't think that those people should be written off as completely anti-immigration all the time. They're only going to vote on immigration as an issue.
Well, I don't think anyone votes on immigration purely without any reference to any other policies. But
I think that that's what is put forward as why, especially with the referendum, that's put forward as the main reason why people voted Leave. And they didn't. They vote like immigration is forefront in their mind because that's all of the media that they consume, and that's all the things that it's a very easy thing to be angry at because it's there and it's visible and it's different. But the reason that they are angry and they need something to be angry at is because of the politicians in Westminster who failed them.
I mean, I think it is true that the things about, say, investment in public services and the jobs market and all the stuff you just referenced, all of that is a problem, and it does feed into the general fear of migration. But I suspect that for some people don't buy into the whole multicultural society thing. You know, so some people don't want to live in diverse communities, as you would put it. I don't think it, obviously, everyone's view of all policy areas interacts with other policy areas. No area can be considered purely in isolation. But there is something I think essential about the migration debate. There are some people who don't necessarily see migration as a positive in a cultural sense, or they don't want an awful lot of it, let's say.
Sure. Shall we talk about the potential Labour leadership coup that's happening? So Angela Eagle, who is the ex-shadow business secretary since she quit her job in protest at Jeremy Corbyn's leadership, she is rumoured to be standing and challenging Jeremy Corbyn to the leadership in the next couple of days.
Can I ask, in a broader sense, who is Angela Eagle? I know you've just given her a former job title, but before Corbyn was a thing, who was she? What's her background in the Labour Party?
She's of the left of the party, probably around the same kind of area as Ed Miliband. She's the second MP to come out as a lesbian, and she has a twin. There you go.
And her twin's called, who is also an MP?
Maria Eagle,
yeah. Did you see, just on a tangent, Justine Greening came out as a lesbian recently?
Yeah, brilliant. Welcome to the club, Justine.
But didn't she vote against gay marriage? I remember she was quite vacillating at one point in a Question Time debate about the whole gay marriage issue.
You'd be surprised how strong internalised homophobia can be, Jimmy.
Anyway, sorry, Angela Eagle. Do you think she'd make a good leader of the Labour Party?
I would be confused as to where she stands specifically on issues. I don't think her goal is actually to lead the Labour Party. I don't think she particularly wants to. She wants to mount a coup so that Jeremy has to leave, and then she will let other people come in and actually take the leadership. I think that that's what her plan is. I think that she would be a much more effective leader than Jeremy Corbyn. She is incredibly good in terms of presentation when she is at Prime Minister's Questions, because she has been substituting for Jeremy Corbyn. When the Prime Minister isn't there, Jeremy Corbyn doesn't debate George Osborne, but Angela Eagle debates George Osborne. And Angela Eagle has been brilliant in those kinds of performances. And that is important. It's a very superficial and very skin-deep part of our politics, but those kinds of performances are really important, and she's good at that. Frankly, they need somebody who is going to get the backing of the PLP, of the Parliamentary Labour Party, all of their members of Parliament. And she'd do a much better job at doing that than Jeremy Corbyn would.
So I think we had this argument last week about whether or not Corbyn would automatically get on the ballot. And there's some kind of legal disagreement going on in the Labour Party about whether that's true or not.
Can you explain that very quickly for the guys who maybe didn't listen last week?
So the rules of Labour leadership elections are unclear as to whether if an incumbent leader is challenged, whether they automatically get on the ballot paper or whether they need to be nominated by, I think it's 35 MPs in order to get on the ballot paper. Obviously, Jeremy Corbyn is quite unpopular with his MPs at the moment, to put it mildly. And so there's some question as to whether he would get enough nominations to get on the ballot paper. But so there's a disagreement within the Labour Party as to what the rules actually mean. And it might, in theory, it could be arbitrated by a court of some sort, although in practice, I don't really know whether we'd have time for that, given the time frame around Brexit and around any potential general election. If he got on the ballot paper, though, one way or the other, I think he would probably win.
I think he would win as well. Even though they had 60,000 people join the Labour Party in the last couple of weeks since the referendum, since he's had this... So there's rumours that people are joining the party, this 60,000 people. They are joining the party to either save Jeremy Corbyn or get Jeremy Corbyn out. And nobody seems to be sure who these people are who are joining the Labour Party. This is part of Ed Miliband's legacy, Ed Miliband being the previous leader of the Labour Party, who basically opened up membership to anybody who has a laptop and £3 to spare. It's ridiculous, because it's been taken over by a left-wing fringe. Basically, the Socialist Workers' Party is now running our nation's opposition, and it's incompetent. I agree that if he gets on the ballot paper, he'll win. He won with 60% of the votes against five. How many was it? Against four other or three other people who were going for the job.
Three other people were Liz Kendall, Yvette Cooper, and Andy Burnham, who's now retreated to Manchester, where he's hiding from general view. The assumption is that if he gets on the ballot paper, Corbyn wins. Does that mean that the rebels' only hope is to block him from somehow getting on the ballot paper?
I think so, yeah. What do you think happens if he does get on the ballot paper and he wins? Do we see the Labour Party combust?
I said this on the previous episode, and I still think it's true that the Blairite wing of the Labour Party, or the non-Corbyn wing of the Labour Party, their best bet is to form some sort of political pact with a party like the Lib Dems or the Greens, or
alongside the SNP.
Alongside the SNP. Because this actually has happened. There have been splits in parliamentary parties before, and by that I mean the MPs. It is actually entirely possible that the Labour MPs who don't like Jeremy Corbyn can abandon him in the House of Commons, form their own grouping, they don't necessarily need to form their own party, but they can form their own grouping and be declared the official opposition, because they'll have more MPs than Jeremy Corbyn will have, and they'll still have more MPs than the SNP will have. Something like that is the only way forward I can see. And I think in the Sunday Times the other day, I think it was Neil Kinnock was advocating for not Neil Kinnock, it was Paddy Ashdown of the Liberal Democrats who was advocating
interesting.
For some sort
does
of solution
he want
like that.
A Social Democrats 2.0? Social Democrats were essentially, if anybody doesn't know, breakaway Labour MPs in the 1980s who, in very similar circumstances, had grievances about the left who had taken over the party. They split from Labour, created the Social Democrats, and then eventually blended with the then Liberal Party to create what we now call the Liberal Democrats.
Mm. And actually the Social Democrats and the Liberals, as they were known at the time, their alliance almost got more votes, at least in terms of pure numbers, than the Labour Party. I think at some point during the 70s, that was probably during like the Michael
it was
Foot.
The 80s it was, the,
was it was, the 80s
it was Margaret Thatcher's second election.
Well, there you go. And it was I don't think they were particularly near to getting more seats than the Labour Party. But
nowhere near. This is the problem with our election system. Sorry, am I rabbiting on about a seat?
It is a problem. I don't know how that will play out in practice, because obviously we still have first past the post, which makes it very difficult for...
And as long as the Conservative Party is in power through first past the post, they have absolutely no intention of changing it. The Conservative Party, I was very... shaken isn't the word, because I'm not terrified of Conservatives. I have Conservative tendencies to a certain extent. But something that is impressive from them as an organisation is that they have been in government longer than any other party in the history of mankind ever. They've held power for more years than any other political party in existence.
I've got to say, though, like, I'm assuming that statistic relies on the previous Tory party, as it was actually called. They were called the Tories before they were called the Conservative and Unionist Party, which is actually their real current name. And that I'm not entirely sure it's legitimate for them to claim that as a consistent run, as it were, because the political parties were quite different in the 19th century. But anyway,
speaking of the, thanks for that little bit of history there, Jeremy. I'm sure everybody appreciated it. Speaking of the Tories, so what's happening?
So there are five. If you've only joined...
Do you want to talk briefly about Boris and what the fuck happened?
So if you've gone on holiday and you've decided to switch the news off, and I'm not entirely sure I blame you,
you've decided that this is the first piece of news that you listen to, first of all, thank you very much. We're very honoured.
People have said they rely on us for their news, which is terrifying in many
You're
ways.
Idiots. You're all idiots.
But anyway,
our tagline is only as accurate as sources permit. Our sources aren't great.
Anyway, so Boris Johnson, I think I even said at last podcast that he was a shoo-in for the leadership. Everyone thought he was the favourite to win, although before he withdrew from the race, Theresa May was making some pretty impressive gains on him in terms of MP support and public polling support as well. But he was betrayed by Michael Gove, who was supposed to be on his side, but had said, like, I back Boris as leader. And it, judging from reading the Sunday
papers...
Well,
they campaigned for Brexit together.
Judging by the Sunday papers, Michael Gove decided that Boris, in the wake of the Leave vote, was behaving too incompetently and too erratically. He wrote a column for the Daily Telegraph where he rode back on a lot of... the promises that he'd made during the Brexit campaign concerning things like migration and our relationship to the European single market. So Michael Gove decided he'd run as leader, and Boris, working with Lynton Crosby, who's the famous kind of or infamous political campaigning consultant who masterminded Boris's election to the London mayor and also the last a Conservative general election campaign, decided it would be better to pull him out rather than get caught up in all the arguments that are going to take place in this leadership.
Do you think he would have stood a chance?
Probably not, really. Boris's main weakness as a Tory leadership candidate is that a lot of the MPs in his party don't like him. And the way that a Tory leadership campaign works is that you can have pretty much as many candidates as you like, because you only need two MPs to nominate you in order to stand for the Tory leadership. And if you can't find two MPs, well, that's pretty sad, really. Once you've been nominated, they work out how many candidates there are on the field, and they have a series of successive voting rounds where the candidate with the fewest MPs backing them gets knocked out each time until you only have two. And because Boris isn't very popular among MPs, I'm not sure he would have made it into the last two, basically, at which point the choice is put to the general membership of the Tory party. That's the 150,000 that Jazza was talking about before. And then you end up with the leader of the Tory party, who in this case will also be prime minister. But yeah, I don't think Boris...
Fun little quick promotion for them, wouldn't it be? Tell us who is running, Jimmy.
So Theresa May, already mentioned Michael Gove. There's the gay cure guy, Stephen Crabb.
So Stephen Crabb is the MP. He's the
Work and Pensions Minister.
An MP for Pembrokeshire. He is controversial because he has previously taken money from gay conversion therapy organisations. So fun times.
Do you want to explain what a gay conversion therapy thing is?
Gay conversion therapy is the belief that you can cure somebody of their homosexuality.
Yeah, so that's interesting.
Yeah, it's great. Really good to know that. It's a shame because he is the most attractive of the runners.
In a stiff field, it has to be said. You know?
Yeah. There's also Liam Fox, who has been... many people are just saying that he's doing this run so that he becomes to the forefront of British politics again. I tend to believe that. I don't think that even he believes that he has a chance.
So he's kind of like a slightly... He probably would fit in UKIP. Like, he wouldn't be out of place in UKIP as an MP. He's quite right-wing, I think you can say.
So Liam Fox backed Brexit. Stephen Crabb, who we previously talked about, was a Remainer. And then there is Angela Leadsom, who is also a Remainer. You will probably know her if you saw
She's a Brexiter, isn't she?
She's a Brexiter.
But she did previously say leaving the EU would be a disaster, so it's understandable that Jazza is a bit confused about this.
I mean, because she is too. She was one of the debaters at the massive BBC debate at Wembley for the Brexit side. And then, obviously, Theresa May makes five.
So, because we've slagged off all the candidates in some way, Theresa May, terrible record on civil liberties, doesn't really understand how the internet works, and Andrea Leadsom
doesn't want to release her tax returns. She's an ex-banker. Oh, I wonder why she doesn't want to release her tax returns.
I was just going to go with interesting tax arrangements, but, you know, your version works too.
Thanks. Govey stabbed people in the back and has thus become quite unpopular. Liam Fox is just a bit crazy.
Yeah, It's a great choice, great
selection
of people.
Yeah, and as we said, Krabby believes that I can be cured of the gay. So great. So it looks like so far. So they have to go through an initial ballot of the members of parliament. When's that taking place, Jimmy? Do you know? Is it tomorrow?
Yeah, so the first round, as it were, as I said.
So probably as you listen to this, it's happening on Tuesday, the 5th of July. So you'll probably be listening to this on that day. MPs are going to be doing the initial ballot. There's 330 MPs, and they will continue to do a ballot until all of the runners are knocked out. And then they have two candidates that they take to the Conservative membership. We already have Theresa May with 103, I believe, the last time that I checked.
I've got 112 here from Laura Koonsberg, the BBC politics editor.
Doing ever so well, isn't she, our Theresa?
Yeah.
She's on 103 pledges from members of parliament. So this is where it gets interesting. Liam Fox and Stephen Crabbe are a bit of a write-off at the moment. They're on...
I'm not sure that's true. So these are just the figures I have. So Liam Fox...
Okay, lay it out for us. Lay it out.
So I've got May 112, Jazza says 103, so it's obviously above 100. Andrea Leadsom is 38. But she's actually ahead of both Gove and Crabbe, who have Gove, it says here, has 26, Crabbe has 23, so they're about on par with one another. Then Liam Fox is 9, so realistically Liam Fox is going to get knocked out in the first round, but after that things get quite interesting, I think.
I do too, and people who were assuming it was going to be a Gove Theresa May runoff, I don't think that's going to be a case. I reckon it will be Andrea. I'm purely going by first and second place, but and also by the tone of the leavers that I follow on Twitter, which is clearly the best way of getting the tone of campaign. But there is a lot of pushback on Gove, and a lot of support for Andrea Leadsom. I reckon it will be a lady on lady contest.
Is that in some ways that's just a quirk of the way that the the chips have fallen, as it were.
Do you
think that will change the way the leadership contest is, like the final two at least? Do you think that will change the way that that contest is actually run? Because
it's two women?
Yeah, basically.
I don't think so, but I reckon that Andrea Leadsom could beat Theresa May. Because she is Theresa May was a Remainer. Andrea Leadsom was a Brexiter. Andrea Leadsom also doesn't have a huge amount of political baggage, really. She was seen as coming out of the campaign relatively unscarred. To be fair, so did Theresa May. But as we've talked about before in the past, the Tory base is incredibly Eurosceptic. And there is a very strong argument for people wanting there to be a Brexiter to be the person who leads the UK into negotiations, because that's what the public voted for. I have an interesting theory on this, Jimmy. Would you like to hear it?
I'm ecstatic. What's this theory?
So there has been whispers that actually, or there has been the idea that actually, for people like me who would like Brexit to never happen, it's better for us to have a Brexit Prime Minister, because they are more likely to be able to go back to their electorate, the people who voted Leave, and to say to them, this deal is shit, we shouldn't do it. Theresa May will be obligated to carry out Brexit, because otherwise she will be seen as a traitor and not the unifying force that she claims to be. Our best chance for Brexit not happening, and this obviously is not something that you agree with, Jimmy, because you're a swivelised loon. But Andrea Leadsom is the best bet for people like me who want Brexit not to happen. There's my theory. Take it or leave it.
So both May and Leadsom have baggage as far as being on the Remain side go. Like, Theresa May was a very soft Remain. She didn't really campaign either way.
Makes it sound like a foundation. I'm wearing a soft Remain.
Whereas, as I mentioned before, Leadsom has got on the record saying Brexit would be a disaster. And realistically, if either of them were Prime Minister and came back with... came back from the Brexit deal saying this is a terrible deal, I don't think that, obviously that wouldn't go down well with a lot of people. But we were talking about Article 50 earlier, and I don't think it's possible to have any substantial, I don't think politically it's possible to have any substantial negotiations on Brexit
before you trigger Article 50.
Exactly.
So here's a question I have, Jimmy. And I think that it's interesting because there's no precedent for this happening because nobody has ever left the European Union before. Mm. But once Article 50 is triggered, is it possible to de-trigger it?
I've heard opinions on both sides of this, this argument. So my short answer is no one knows, basically.
Yeah. And who'd have thought? Oh, people who were campaigning to stay in the EU, we were saying that it was a jump in the dark. Who'd have thought that we'd have been right?
Well, in a sense.
Sorry, I don't get many chances to gloat, Jimmy.
I never said that it wasn't going to be without uncertainty, but unlike the official Leave campaign, mm-hmm. but I think it will come down to politically what's possible. These arguments about what the actual legal mechanism is, to a degree, I think are irrelevant. There's this big argument at the moment as to whether the Prime Minister can invoke 50 on his or her own without the need to go before Parliament.
It's very unlikely that it would be possible without a vote in Parliament.
I disagree, actually, and if you read...
No, but like legally, I don't think it's possible.
No, legally there is a massive amount of uncertainty about whether it's possible. Politically, I don't think it's likely to happen. But that kind of emphasises my point, that we're in uncharted legal waters here, both within the UK and with the UK and the EU's relationship. And I think a lot of it will be defined more by the politics of it than the actual legal wording of various things. Although I'm not saying the legal wording is irrelevant. I just think the politics will override it if push comes to shove.
So do you think I'm right that it's going to be a Leeds and May runoff?
That's what the evidence from the MPs says. I think what will happen is as Fox and Gove fall away, their supporters are more likely to go behind Leadsom than they are May, and that will push Leadsom ahead of Crabb, assuming that he's even.
Gove is also incredibly unpopular at the moment within the Conservative Party. It's been seen as very uncouth the way that he stabbed poor Boris and Cameron in the back.
I don't know. I mean, he's working in a grand Conservative tradition of shafting. Shafting your friends even worse than you shaft your enemies.
Do you think the whole point of it was so that Boris didn't run? Do you think that he may have heard Boris whisper and toy with the idea that he wasn't going to trigger Article 50?
No, I don't really buy that. I think I actually kind of buy the official story is probably putting it a bit too strongly, but I think that Gove probably intended to back Boris until the last fortnight and then decided it was actually a terrible idea. He probably harboured doubts about Boris for like the entirety of the Brexit campaign, because who wouldn't, you know?
Yeah. I mean,
if you're working with Boris Johnson for day in, day out, you're going to have some serious second thoughts about what the fuck it is you're doing with your life. I do buy the idea that he, in the wake of the Leave vote, Boris behaved incompetently and Gove decided enough was enough.
Fair enough. Is there anything else that you'd like to say about the Tory leadership contest?
Not so much, but before we wrap up, do you think there should be a general election before we finally leave the European Union?
There needs to be some kind of general election once there is a new government formed that have set out their stakes for what we are going to look like in Brexit. I think it would be crazy if we were to trigger Article 50 without even having some kind of a plan of what our country looks like.
So your hope is that the Tories will finish their election, Labour will in some way resolve the whatever the fuck it is going on there, and then there'll be a general election, and whichever party wins or manages to form a government then gets to negotiate Brexit?
Yes.
Okay. Do you think that's going to happen?
There you go. I hope so.
I guess we'll see. All right.
Yeah, sorry, that wasn't overly controversial or anything. Jimmy, I'm clinging on to straws here.
Should we wrap this up then?
Yeah, let's wrap it up. If you enjoy this, please do subscribe to us on iTunes. And also, if you have a moment, please just go over to click on the title of the Write to Snuggle podcast, go into there, and then leave us a little review. Leave us 5 stars, because that's always very nice. It helps with our discovery. It means more and more people get to listen to us and engage with us. Speaking of engagement, please do go over to Twitter and talk to us on there. Feel free to abuse either of us as much as you like. We love a little bit of abuse. We're a bit sadistic. Like that. You can find us on Twitter.
I think you mean masochistic rather than sadistic.
Ah, yes. Thank you. Thanks there. I'm going to blame the dyslexia. You can find us on Twitter at @RightDishonor, or go to our website, leave us a comment on this episode, The Right Dishonorable. It's rightdishonorable.com.
Yeah, I think either one works, actually.
Oh, excellent.
Amazing.
Oh, clever getting both of the domain names, you clever boy.
Yeah, genius. Great.
Well, I wouldn't go that far. next week we're meant to have a guest. Teaser. Aren't I a little dull?
You're not going to reveal the guest in case he pulls out.
Just in case he pulls out.
That would
be
embarrassing.
We've revealed the gender. Anyway, bye. I've been Jazza.
I've been Jimmy.
Toodaloo.